From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, the Texas population boom continues to astonish, but as more people move to Texas, is Texas ready? In that population is a demographic shift. Texas and the nation is getting less white faster than expected. And an ill wind blows for renewable energy. Is there a misinformation campaign against green power? This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Over the past decade, Texas has seen incredible growth. In 2007, the state's population was almost 24 million. Today, it stands at over 28 million, and the forecast is more growth. The state's population is expected to double in size by 2050, with projections putting its population at 54 million. A Pew Trust report out this week says Texas and other fast-growing states need to prepare for this exploding population. Matt McKillop is the study's lead author.
What we looked at was population growth in all 50 states over the past 10 years, as well as in the past year, so 2017. And in both cases, we see Texas growing faster than most other states in the country. So over the past decade, it grew second fastest at a rate of 1.7% per year. And then in the most recent year, it grew seventh fastest in the country at a rate of 1.4%. So western and southern states tended to grow fastest over that decade, and Texas consistently was one of the fastest growing states in the South.
So we're looking at the rate of growth, but also numerically, Texas is also raising eyebrows.
Right. So what we looked at was the annual rate of growth over that 10-year period. So
the fastest growing is Utah, but, you know, you're looking at the rate, but, you know, Utah now has 4 million people in it.
Right.
Texas now has 28 million people in it.
Mm-hmm.
So the numbers and the rate, I think, for Texas, it's because it's already a high population state, at the rate of growth, I think, you know, that's a double whammy.
Yes. So certainly as a large state, by growing quickly, Texas added a number of people and added more people than most other states.
So when you have this rate of growth for a state like Texas, this means that you're going to have additional demands for services and that states need to prepare for it. And it looks like Texas is locked into a trend of this type of growth. So are y'all looking at that?
A big reason why we looked at these data to begin with was their relationship to both states' economies as well as their fiscal fortunes, so their how their budgets are affected. So generally speaking, state population growth and state economic growth tend to be intertwined. They affect one another. So that is to say that as a state's population grows quickly, more often than not, you'll also see relatively quick economic growth. It can also happen in the other direction as well, where if a state is having an economic boom, that can draw residents into the state and sort of serve as a cyclical relationship in that way. As a state's economy speeds up and growth becomes quicker, that also tends to result in higher tax revenue collections as well. So it also relates to the budget in that sense. Though, as you say, there's also the other side of the budget equation, which is that if you're a fast-growing state, there's going to be more demand for services, and that has to be something that's figured into both the immediate budget concerns as well as longer-term concerns.
But there's a lot of things that you have to provide for a growing population that require investment from a government, whether it be statewide or on a hyper-local level, that require front-end investments. That meaning like building schools and also building the infrastructure for the growing populations. And in planning for this growth in a smart way. I mean, if you don't plan for the growth, then the growth can be like a tumor. I mean, growth is not always a good thing.
That's true. Growth is neither necessarily a good thing or a bad thing. There's no best pace of growth for a given state. But as you say, whether you're growing quickly or slowly, that does have implications both for your economy and for your budget, and you have to plan for that. So, you know, in the case of Texas, with their rapid growth relative to other states, they do need to account for the increased demand for services that's going to produce, both in immediately as well as further out and into the long term.
Are you able to dive into who's making that journey?
Generally, what we've seen for decades is that a move from the Northeast and Midwest into Western and Southern states. That's been a long-term trend, and it continued during the period that we looked at. We did not do an analysis of where people were migrating from particular states to other states, but in the main, that has been an overarching trend that we see. There's also there's sort of two big components to population change in a state, both in a particular year as well as over a decade as we looked at it. And so that's natural increases, which is the number of births you have relative to deaths, and then also migration, which would be both domestic migration from other states where people move in from perhaps neighboring states or other states, as well as international migration, where people are moving in from abroad or leaving to move out in internationally or to move out to other states. And so when we look at Texas, we see that that population was growing for all of those reasons. So it was being pushed up by both natural increases with more births than deaths, as well as people moving in from other states and from abroad.
But there are states that are losing population.
That's right. So there were two states in our analysis over the decade to lost population. So that was Michigan and West Virginia, and there were eight states, which was the most in almost 30 years, that lost residents in 2017.
And we, you know, Michigan's part of the Rust Belt, West Virginia, coal mining company. They look like they're in economic downturn. Could that be the reason for the exodus?
Well, the economy certainly influences people's decisions about where they move and when to move. So we've certainly seen it happen that, for example, North Dakota, as they experienced an oil boom over this period, we saw that draw in a number of residents from other places. So it can certainly serve as a motivator in that sense. And as you say, when a state's economy is struggling, that can be one reason, for example, why people might leave a state to move to another state. So certainly that can be one factor in that decision. And then, you know, as I was describing, that then has sort of an interdependent relationship where as people come and go, that has that also then in turn has an effect on the economy and ultimately on state budgets.
Matt McKillop manages the Pew Trust Research for Fiscal 50, a resource that helps policymakers gain insight into economic and demographic trends. Looking deeper into this population shift, what about the demographics inside the growth? The overall U.S. population is getting less white, according to data from the U.S. Census Bureau. Deaths now outnumber births among white people in more than half of the states in the nation. And the already recognized trend of a coming white minority is happening sooner than first predicted. Rogelio Sainz is a demographer at the University of Texas at San Antonio and is a co-author of a report out this week that looks into this pattern.
Demographers have been talking about demographic shifts taking place in the U.S., particularly along racial and ethnic lines. And we've seen the aging of the white population, and you've been seeing kind of the dropping fertility, the population getting older, larger percentage of the population 65 and older, and so forth. So all of these trends have produced these changes. But demographers tended to suggest that they would be taking place probably a little bit further into the future, and this has now been taking place. It started with Florida, probably in the early 1990s, because of a lot of the elderly migration there in that particular state. So Florida was the first one that experienced a natural decline, that is more deaths and births in the white population. And then there were places like Pennsylvania, West Virginia that were among the first, and then California first experienced it in 2000, and ever since that, with the exception of a year or two, it has been consistently natural decrease state for the white population. So that kind of these changes that demographers have been projecting, that you're going to have whites becoming the numerical minority in the future, these data seem to suggest that that might be taking place sooner, maybe a few years sooner, rather than what was projected earlier.
The category of whites being a minority, that means different things. Are we talking about whites versus all of the other categories, demographics?
Yeah, for the most part, where people talk about when will it be that the whites would become the numerical majority, it has always been the non-Hispanic white versus everybody else. So Asians, Latinos, African Americans, multiracial, and so forth.
But whites would be the largest minority?
In terms of the comparisons, when people say, when will, so that a few years ago, the Census Bureau had indicated that in 2045, that's where whites would be less than 50% of the U.S. population, and everybody else would be the non-whites, which would be above the 50%.
But so we're talking about, yep, if you add up Hispanics, African Americans,
exactly, yeah,
Native peoples,
Asians, yeah, and as well as multiracial. So with a multiracial, you may have individuals who are white, but they also saying that they're Latino, or white and African American, but that they're multiracial.
You can move a population trend, a family line, from white to multiracial, but you don't have people who are multiracial or African American minority becoming white, right?
Right. So that's always been the kind of tricky question. What is going to happen to individuals who have, let's say, a Mexican American father and a white mother, with respect to the, of course, with a census, it's how people identify themselves. So for children, for example, it may be one parent that is filling out the census questionnaire or the questionnaire for the American Community Survey, and then they would impute kind of a race or Hispanic origin for their children. Even though we think that these are categories, you know, that rigid or so forth, or that they're prescriptive, in reality, there's a lot of that imputation that takes place with respect to parents. And then for the multiracial individuals, let's say, again, the person with a Mexican-American father and a white mother, then they would, it's all self-identification. So as an adult, they would be choosing their own race, how they identify, and so forth. But in a lot of the population projections, it assumes, you know, pretty much that if somebody is multiracial, that they will continue being multiracial, and that there's not any movement that then all of a sudden they decide, oh, I'm going to be white instead of a Mexican-American. And
yeah, well, I mean, whiteness is conditional.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. People like to think of race as being rigid and as, you know, defined, and you can't move from one race to another, but it happens.
In reality, it's fairly fluid.
This trend, this has been predicted for a long time, but it appears to be happening sooner.
About 2 years ago, we had my colleague Ken Johnson and I, who's at He's at the University of New Hampshire. We had done a similar study, and then at that point we had found out that there were 17 states that had a white natural decrease, again, more deaths than births. And then we were projecting that this would probably be adding another 2-3 states in the next few years. But when we revisited the data, again, 2 years later, there were an additional 9 that followed suit with this white natural decrease. And part of that, I think, has been the impact of dropping fertility among whites with the impact of the Great Recession. It also impacted other racial and ethnic groups as well. But the impact on whites was probably greater because of the aging. You have fewer women who are in those childbearing ages, 15 to 44. So there are fewer women than that are producing babies. And then, of course, the aging that is taking place, and you have the baby boomers then that are moving to the older age categories where the probability of death is higher. And then something very interesting, I think, that is also taking place, the reason why we're seeing states then that perhaps without this particular factor that I'm about to talk about, it may have been 4, 5, 6 years down the line that they may have postponed white natural decrease. But in the last 7, 8 years, you've had the increase in mortality among whites, particularly working class whites. And some of this is attributed to the opioid epidemic and some of the rising drug overdoses that we've seen. So in some respects, I think that those deaths are kind of speeding up a few years, the white natural decline, where there are more deaths than births.
So a lot of the research is broken down by states. But
yeah,
in actuality, states are kind of an arbitrary way to kind of break up the population.
Right, yeah.
So if we tried to remove the state lines and look at areas more according to, I guess, their region, what would that look like?
The regional aspects that you have are very much the New England area, kind of the Northeast, and area along the southwest from New Mexico to California and up into Oregon. That kind of seems to be those states that are the ones that are experiencing the natural decrease. And some of the more recent ones that have joined the ranks have been like Tennessee, Oklahoma, and then North Carolina and South Carolina. So kind of a U-shape, excluding places like Texas. Texas is one of the ones that has not followed the trend.
Texas is a big geographic area, and we know that this is not uniform across Texas.
Yeah, exactly. So if you look at the Hill Country, for example, where there's been a lot of migration of older individuals, if you look at rural areas, where younger folks leave once they finish high school, go to the bigger cities for jobs and so forth, that you have probably certain parts of Texas that are already very much in line with these natural decrease. And on the other hand, you have areas where you have more the large urban areas where you have the greater numbers of white younger people in those populations that are still in kind of the white natural increase. Meaning more births than deaths.
So we have counties in Texas, in the Hill Country particularly, where we have a median age that is well over 60. What is the tipping point when that destiny becomes apparent?
Okay, so in terms of a tipping point with respect to natural decrease trend? Yeah, and the factors that seem to be associated with that are the birth rate. What the birth rate is, the proportion of the overall population that consists of women who are capable of giving birth, and then the percentage of the population that are 65 and older. So those seem to be the three most important factors. So you look at a place like Llano or Llano, where you have a high proportion of the population that are over 65, a very small share of women who are 15 to 44, that childbearing ages, and extremely low levels of fertility, and those are the ingredients that produce this natural decrease.
Is there a point when the white population becomes no longer the dominant minority population, and say and the Hispanics or another group becomes the majority?
2022 seems to be the date here in Texas, the year here in Texas where Latinos become the numerical majority in the state, overcoming the white population. In the nation, that's still further down the line. The last population projections were suggesting about 2045 or so. That might be it might be a little bit sooner given some of these trends.
Rogelio Sainz is a demographer at the University of Texas at San Antonio and is the co-author of the report, White Deaths Exceed Births in a Majority of U.S. States, a census data brief by the Applied Population Lab. Texas is going to need more electric power to deal with the arrival of all these new people, and the good news is that Texas has plenty of power and it's green. Wind power continues to expand across Texas, and it's gaining an increased share in the state's power grid, producing 17.4% of the state's electric juice in 2017. And more billion-dollar investments are pouring into Texas to reap more of that wind. Despite this success, or perhaps because of it, there is an increase in misinformation about wind power on social media and in the public square. Jeff Clark is the president of the Wind Coalition of Texas.
Texas wind continues to grow and expand across the state, which is lowering prices, now saves consumers in Texas over $1 billion a year on their electric bills, and more importantly, cleans the air while making us dependent on our own resources. Instead of continuing to bring in fuel from outside of the state, we can now provide our own power. So right now, wind is growing, and it's a tremendous success story for Texas.
We still see more of those turbines being hauled down the freeway quite a bit. It seems like there's still more wind development happening across the state.
There is. Communities want wind because it's a tremendous, for rural areas, a tremendous economic development opportunity. And for school districts, it's a tremendous new growth in the tax base. For consumers, it's cheaper, cleaner electricity made in Texas. So it's a win-win-win across the board for consumers across the state and citizens across the state. There has been a misinformation campaign, and we're beginning to see a lot of out-of-state fossil fuel money flowing into Texas trying to attack what renewables are accomplishing here and, frankly, what the natural gas industry is accomplishing here in that shift away from dirtier fuels and to zero-emission sources like renewables and lower-emission sources like natural gas. One of the misinformation points that I have heard is that the wind turbine, the manufacture of a wind turbine itself, emits a lot of CO2 and other greenhouse gases. And the fact of the matter is that a wind turbine lasts for 25 to 30 years, and within 5 to 8 months of its useful life, it completely offsets all of the greenhouse gases that went into its manufacture. And so this is a very clean and, frankly, zero-emission source of electricity for a state that's growing and needs electricity, and most importantly, needs it abundantly and affordably. Texas is tremendously blessed with renewable energy resources like wind and solar, and we're capitalizing on those.
So there does seem to be an organized effort to turn people against green energy, wind power. I've seen memes online, just like the one you mentioned. Also, other people saying that wind energy only makes sense if there's government subsidies in the mix. Is that true?
You know, it is a very disappointing, and what we see are groups and industries that receive tremendous amounts of government subsidies and tax incentives and tax breaks and liability protections. They don't bear the full cost of their operations. In fact, those are placed on the backs of the taxpayer. It's tremendously disappointing to see that organized effort that is taking place where those industries are taking some of the profits that they have made, you know, frankly, with government support and using those resources to attack renewables. We're seeing an organized and concerted misinformation effort. I think if we want to have a conversation about subsidies in Texas, we're ready to have that conversation. We hope we'll have it about every energy source and not allow some misinformation from out-of-state fossil companies to take away from what renewable energy is accomplishing in the state.
But there is a battle over subsidies that happens every few years. If the subsidies were to go away, what would that mean for wind turbines? The ones that are already in place, they're already in place and will continue to turn, is that or not?
That's correct, yes. In the way the federal tax credit, and the beauty of the incentive, there are industries that receive a subsidy, you know, simply for operate, you know, for production. The way the wind energy and production tax credit has worked is the direct benefit to consumers in that it is offered to companies for producing electricity and putting it onto the grid for use. If that incentive, and it is scheduled, and I think it's important to point out that wind is one of the only industries that has come to the table and has agreed to phase out the tax incentives for wind energy, and the production tax credit is scheduled to end. It's ramping down right now. But the projects that have qualified for the production tax credit will receive those credits as promised. But new projects going forward, if the production tax credit is not renewed, will not receive those. Now, what does that mean for Texas? What does it mean for renewable energy and wind primarily? It means that wind projects will have to compete against all of the other forms of energy that receive tax incentives without receiving any type of tax benefit or tax encouragement from the federal government. I think it's also important to remember that these incentives do not mean that projects do not pay taxes. They are credits that mean they pay lower taxes. And so as we've heard the rhetoric out of Washington and Austin, we recognize that cutting taxes encourages business growth. And that's exactly what these incentives do, is they reduce the tax burden of a wind project in order to get them going. But it's most important to remember that every form of energy, going back all the way to the beginning of our country, every form of energy has received encouragement from the federal government to encourage the growth so that we'll have abundant, affordable energy for everybody.
I wonder if, because there are forms of energy that burn carbon and emit carbon into the atmosphere through their smokestacks, that is a form of subsidy as well, because right now they're not taxed on what that puts into the atmosphere and what that does to the air that we all breathe. And that is a cost that is borne by all of us.
There are emission-related issues, there are health-related issues that are tied to those emissions, there are climate-related issues that are tied to those emissions. But there are subsidies hidden all through the tax code. For example, there are companies who move fossil fuel products around the country and have no liability, or have limited liability if an accident were to occur, for example. We see that in the nuclear industry, that there is a cap on damages for nuclear power, where some of that liability beyond a certain point is borne by the taxpayer. And so, again, if we're going to have a discussion about tax incentives or subsidies or changes in the free market that shift the burden from a producer of energy to the taxpayer, then we need to have a holistic discussion about that and look at every form of energy, look at all of the impacts. What does what do the emissions from coal plants mean for the health of Texans, and what does that mean in the form of costs that are borne by the taxpayer in order to provide health care? Let's have that discussion.
Jeff Clark is the president of the Wind Coalition of Texas. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You can also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. And that's where you can find past Texas Matters programs to listen to. And you can find us wherever you get your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.